Although we're getting close to harvest season, even if you haven't planted anything till now, there still might be time. Horticulturist Gerard Lordahl, the director of the Open Space Greening Program at Grow NYC, joins us now, as he has so often over the past 25 years or so, to talk about gardening into the fall. Welcome back to our show, Gerard.
Thanks. It's great to be here, Leonard.
And I used to introduce you as horticulturist and floriculturalist, but that word was so hard to say, I dropped
it's a tongue twister. It's true.
And if you, our listeners, have questions about plants, you can call us at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Gerard, this summer has been a pretty mixed bag in terms of weather. There was a week-long heat wave in late July, also a fair amount of rain, and then cooler days. Has it been good for gardening?
It's been a mixed bag, as you were saying. You know, we had that horrible heat wave of over 100-degree weather where community gardeners lost some of the plant material that they couldn't take care of. Rooftop gardens were suffering during that spell. I was up at Via Verde in the Bronx. That's a rooftop garden. And there was a very difficult week-long of heavy watering during that period, and community gardeners experienced that as well. And then we were coming off Superstorm Sandy, so we had a lot of damage from the October superstorm that caused a lot of repercussions in the spring, with a lot of dead landscape plant material that succumbed to the high salt concentrations. And then it got cool. The reservoirs are now above normal, so they're, I think, at about 90% capacity. So we have had a good amount of rain, but it got cool really fast, and people are asking why their tomatoes aren't fruiting, and things are a little delayed.
Well, you've been doing this for a long time. Have weather patterns changed in this area? As I remember it, August used to be the hottest, most humid month, and now it seems to have shifted to July.
I think there are definitely patterns. I'm over 50 now, and I see the patterns in my own life. You know, some years are better than others. Some are more consistent than others. But as gardeners, we all have to deal with the temperature, and the climate change has definitely been a factor. So when your listeners call me after the show, they ask me about things like, what are some drought-tolerant plants? What are some seaside plantings that I could plant that will tolerate drought but yet can withstand the salt concentration from something like Superstorm Sandy? We're doing a lot of sandy recovery in gardens along the Rockaways. You can imagine there was a lot of tree damage, et cetera, along the tri-state area, the Jersey Shore. One thing people are asking right now, if you see that beautiful flowering small tree, crepe myrtle is in bloom now, and a lot of people are calling asking what that tree is along the Jersey Shore, and here in New York City you see it quite a bit. So ligustrum or crepe myrtle is in bloom right now.
And they have withstood the damage that Sandy wreaked, because you were mentioning the salt water.
Exactly.
Did people have to replace their soil?
Oh, lots of plant material and soil was replaced along the Zone 1 areas in the Rockaways, along the Jersey Shore, Long Island, you name it. Plus, the inland, there was a lot of tree damage. So if you go along the seashore area along the North Atlantic, you can see lots of browned evergreens that just couldn't take the salt concentration. In my own backyard in Sheepshead Bay and Manhattan Beach, if you walk along the boardwalk area, you'll see a lot of private landscapes and even in parks where evergreen trees are just totally brown. And you can tell that was from the concentration of ocean water that came in and killed the plant material. That's a lot of that has had to be replaced.
Now, how did that affect people who were growing their plants in pots or in raised beds?
Sure. Well, you know, there are over 600 community gardens in New York City that we work with, tens of thousands of volunteer community gardeners. And right after Sandy, they were asking the local universities, the state governments, how to handle the surge water that affected their vegetable plants in pots.
And you don't have to salt any of the vegetables when you cook them.
Yeah, well, now we can laugh about it. It's true. But at the time, people were really upset. Their gardens got washed away. And, you know, it was a health hazard. So the recommendation was, if the soil sits for 6 months or so, the academics were saying that a lot of the salt would leach through. The rain would cause a lot of the petroleum distillates to move through the soil and not be an issue. If there was an issue with heavy metals like cadmium, mercury, or lead, it was highly recommended that they have their soil tested. And we helped a lot of community gardens have their soil tested by either Cornell University or University of Massachusetts at Amherst. And a lot of soil was replaced. We had a lot of foundations and corporations that stepped up and gave us funding to replace truckloads of soil. There's a huge 41,000 square foot garden we're working with in the Rockaways with Bed-Stuy Coalition Against Hunger, and it's Edgemere Farm. And we've already brought in 12 truckloads of soil, and each truck is 20 yards that could fill this room that we're in right now. So that's a lot of soil to start growing new vegetables.
So the Sandy brought in heavy metals as well into the soil?
Well, no. What happened was because we're living in a city where we have combined sewer and rainwater, when a storm like Sandy occurred, all of the sewer backed up, and that water potentially can go into community gardens like in the Lower East Side at the Campos Garden at 12th Street. We had to replace all of their raised beds and bring in all new soil because it was a possibility that the sewage could be existing in that garden where they were growing vegetables.
I always have a solution to the problem of heavy metal. Rock gardens. Anyway.
We love it. We love that.
Now, what about raised beds? Because you do work with the community gardens. Are
sure.
they preferable to pots? What's the advantage of each?
Well, as we said, the issue for New York City is many of the vacant lots that we started on years ago were existing buildings that were raised, and then what was left was construction debris. So community gardens started pretty much, and we go back as far as the turn of the century at the DeWitt Clinton Garden, where there was a school garden there with 200 kids gardening. But more recently, the modern community garden movement started pretty much in the 60s, where you had a lot of flight from the city and vacant land that were previously buildings that were put on fire or raised, and then people, volunteers, were left with these vacant lots, and there was a potential for heavy metals from lead-based paint to be a problem.
And people dropped a lot of trash there as well.
Right, there was a lot of debris, if you had a dry cleaning facility or a chop shop where there was a lot of petroleum distillate, it was a problem. So we've learned over the years that the best way to garden is to build boxes, bring in fresh soil. A lot of gardens are using windrows now, where you don't necessarily have to use lumber or you don't have to build beds. You could put down newspaper, cardboard, mulch, fabric cloth, and then layers of organic material, and then soil, and mound it in such a way that you could grow your vegetables without lumber, let's say. So we're doing a lot of that.
That some people are doing that on rooftops because you can't just lay a whole you can't cover the whole rooftop with soil, so you got to do it in these little lumps.
That's right, and there are more and more green infrastructure projects all over the city, and your listeners often ask for information for the homeowner. I just want to say, if you go to our website, Grow NYC, we have an excellent tutorial on green infrastructure projects. So if you want to do a bioswale, or if you want to build a roof garden, or if you want to consider a rainwater harvesting system for your backyard, there's a really good series of free educational videos and pamphlets and how-to manuals on our website, and it's under Green Infrastructure Techniques. You could learn how to enhance your tree pit, how to build a rain garden, and things like that.
My guest is Lordahl, Lordahl, L-O-R-D-A-H-L, Director of the Open Space Greening of Grow NYC. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I am Leonard Lopate. A couple of things before we get to the calls. How can you tell when it's the right time to pick vegetables and fruit?
Well, it depends on the fruit. Most of us are familiar with the vegetables and fruits when we go to the supermarket or the green market. You want to pretty much picture that fruit, and if it's that right size, then you could go and harvest it. Many of your listeners are educated gardeners who know that you want to harvest leaf lettuce before it goes to seed. Or if you dig down slightly on the top of carrots or some of the root crops, you could see the top of the carrot, and if it's a certain diameter, that means it's ready to pick. You want a mature tomato that's fully ripened.
Now, my squirrels get to my tomatoes when they're fully ripened, but if I pick them 2 days before, I can save them. Will they ripen in my kitchen?
That's a great point. Some fruits and vegetables ripen off of the vine, tomatoes being one. Others do not. You can't pick an early watermelon and then expect it to ripen. So be aware that not all fruits and vegetables ripen off the vine, but tomatoes certainly do.
Now, we're also talking about harvesting, but are there still things that you can plant right now?
Yeah, and the big point I wanted to make to your listeners is we have about 80 days left of planting, and the fall is an excellent time to plant a second vegetable garden, and it's also a great time for planting shrubs and trees and for pruning. So if you, we have like 80 days for things like carrots, kale, Chinese cabbage. It's a little late for things like Brussels sprouts that need about 100 days, but certainly go and plant broccoli, parsley, kohlrabi, spinach, all those things that take about 80 days or less, because we have until about the third week in November before it starts to get freezing.
And a second planting of lettuce.
And then a second planting of any of those cool crops like lettuce, spinach, onions, and that will take us into November.
Well, let's take some calls. And our first caller is Joe. Hi, Joe from Lower Manhattan.
Hi. I wish I had gotten to you a few weeks earlier, but I hope I haven't ruined this plant. This is an indoor question, even though it's summer.
It's okay. We deal with indoor, outdoor, windowsill, garden, whatever. We've even gotten calls from farmers.
You're so accommodating. I have a fern. I'm not sure if it's an asparagus fern or a real fern. It's very feathery, pale yellow-green, and it was seeming to be pot-bound. And what I discovered under the surface were these bulb-like things. I don't know if they were spores or rhizomes. I don't know what the right name for them is, but they were round and sort of liquid, somewhat liquid-filled.
Mm-hmm.
And
Gerard, you know what this is?
Yeah, this is a very interesting plant. The asparagus fern has interesting nodules in the roots, and you don't have to worry about them. But this, it's a great plant. It needs a lot of moisture. It actually is related to lilies. It's not a true fern, and it does get these round nodules in the roots.
It became pot-bound with them, and I wound up cutting off dozens and dozens of them.
Yeah.
And I've repotted them 1 inch beneath new soil, and I'm wondering if there's any chance of their germinating.
If you had enough of the roots that went along with them to go, then it would work. But this is a good spot to remind your listeners that in September, that's the month to bring in your houseplants. So if you have that asparagus fern out on the patio or the deck, bring it in gradually beginning in the end of September, and you could keep them through the winter.
What should we have done with the bulbs that are no longer flowering?
This is the time when actually you can start pulling up your summer bulbs, things like the tuberous begonias or your gladiola. You could harvest those, what we call tender bulbs, as soon as the foliage turns brown. Remove the soil, keep them cool, dark, and dry in like 50-degree temperature in a garage or a basement, and then you could plant them again next year in the summer.
We've got to get to more calls after we take a little break, but people have been writing in as well, and a listener on our show page asks, how do you get rid of weeds without using chemicals?
Oh, digging them up by hand, putting down mulch. There are lots of different ways you can do that. Cover crops can smother them. An easy way for community gardeners is to lay down sheets of newspaper, and that will smother the weeds as well without having to do all that labor-intensive work of digging and pulling.
Well, the problem is when you pull them up, there's usually a little bit that's still left in the soil, and they just come back.
Right. You want to make sure you take the roots. Some people even opt to burn them. There are these backpack flame tools that actually people can use to burn weeds on brick pavement.
But you say that ground cover is a good way. They compete and,
you could actually
and the ground cover
them.
Beats them out.
Right. A lot of community gardeners will do that because they have large areas to take care of. So they'll smother them with mulch, or they'll smother them with newspaper or old carpets or old linoleum. And that will work. And it's no labor involved. Well, little labor.
My guest is horticulturist Gerard Lordahl, the director of Open Space Greening at Grow NYC. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. More right after this. We're back with Gerard Lordahl, the director of Open Space Greening at Grow NYC, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And let's go now to Felix from Connecticut. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes, Felix.
It's actually Philip.
Philip, okay. Well, I was misinformed. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine.
Or you could change your name, whatever you prefer.
Anyhow, good afternoon, Gerald and Leonard. My question is, a few weeks ago, I transplanted a couple spirea and barberry shrubs. I forget the botanical name of the barberry. It's the purple one with the thorns.
Right, we know it.
Anyhow, the leaves all wilted and just fell to the ground. I wanted to know, is it that it's probably in shock, or are they dead?
A general rule of thumb for the gardeners out there, many listeners are aware, when you're working in the garden, you want to wait until the fall or the early spring when the trees are dormant to move them. And there is another exception. You don't want to move magnolias or dogwoods in the fall, because they have less risk of surviving. But the general rule is, when the leaves turn colors in the fall, that's a good time to move your barberry and other shrubs. What you did was you moved it during the time when it's growing the most, and the chance of survival is very slim. So water it as much as possible. Cut it back, whatever has died. Cut back with a good sharp bypass pruning shear, and then pray that it'll survive. But a little TLC might get it through. But really, in general, wait until the fall to transplant, except now your evergreens have gone dormant. So those evergreen shrubs are going dormant now in the summer, and you could actually transplant and move them now, along with your iris and some of your perennials.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you. I live across the street from a park, and it's just covered with leaves, dead leaves. That's something that usually happens much later in the year, and I was surprised by that because we have had a lot of rain this summer.
Yes, we have, and I understand what you're talking about. A lot of the London plains, there are hundreds of thousands of street trees lining New York City streets, and London plain, the plane trees, and a couple of other varieties have early leaf drop. A lot of it has to do with an infectious disease. Anthracnose is a disease that causes problems, and also drought in some cases. It's weather-related as well. But we do get calls from your listeners about the bark of those trees that falls off. That is a natural thing. The bark does drop off those plane trees, but the leaves prematurely drop off because of these diseases and these hot spells that we go through. It doesn't kill the tree. It will survive.
Jonathan from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
We're well. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yes. So I manage an aquaponic community garden in Brooklyn, and we also have some vegetables growing in soil as well. And we've had unbelievable amount of cucumber beetles, and I have no idea how to get rid of them because they're bringing powdery mildew, and it's getting worse and worse by the day.
Right. With cucumber beetle, you could try some of those pheromone traps. There is some effective measure with those, and they're basically just non-toxic sticky traps that have a insect pheromone that attracts the bugs to a container. They work well for fruit flies in worm bins, and Japanese beetles are also effective. You can get them at many of the large discount box stores. So look for those natural beetle traps with the chemical pheromone. It's not a chemical. It's a natural lure that will help you cut down on the cucumber beetle. Hand picking is another thing that some gardeners do. Also, sharp blasts of water from the hose will knock the cucumber beetles out. And you can try some of those methods, and gardeners have found it to be effective with cucumber beetle.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You should definitely check out our garden. It's, I think, the largest aquaponic community garden in New York.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, I'm wondering about bees. We keep on hearing that bees are dying out.
Colony collapse
have
disorder,
we
right?
seen colony collapse in the New York City area as well? Or is
well,
that
I have
more
a couple
likely
of
something
friends
that's happening in farms?
Who are beekeepers? David Graves, you may know him at the Union Square Market. He has Berkshire berries, honey, and he keeps me up to date on how things are doing. And, you know, there still are issues, and there's a lot of bee loss. And from what I understand, that it's still an issue, and we are, you know, the industry is doing what they can to correct the problems with the colony collapse disorder. And, you know, it's something we have to still be vigilant about.
Well, can we as home gardeners do anything? Put
yeah,
up those,
absolutely.
Those butterfly bushes?
Exactly. What they suggest is to plant for your pollinators. When I walked into the studio, someone was asking me about the pollination of their tomatoes. And it's very important, no matter where we are, the suburbs, the rural areas, the city, that we have our pollinators, our bees, our bats, all those different insects in the evening and in the day to pollinate our vegetables. You could do it by hand, but we really rely on our pollinators. So putting out water for the bees is something that's recommended by the beekeepers.
But that also
a little sugar water.
But that'll also bring mosquitoes.
Well, it's not something that you leave out for a long time. Shallow pans in the bird bath of water with some sugar, and that will help the bees. Also, as you said, planting plants like Asclepias for the butterflies and butterfly bush, Buddleia, Davidii, and different types of plants that will attract the pollinators on your rooftop. Marigolds are a big one. A lot of people would do that.
My bees are
trumpet vine.
Like the mint plant.
Mint, bee balm. Monarda is the botanical name for bee balm, which a lot of people like growing. It's a perennial. And I just wanted to remind your listeners, because a lot of people call about roses, Leonard, stop fertilizing your roses at this point in September, because you don't want them to get any new growth that could cause some frost damage. And the other thing is to think about this time of year in your vegetable garden to put down a cover crop like winter ryegrass or vetch or even soybean. You could put it down now, right? Even before you harvest your produce from the vegetable garden, and then you work that into the soil in the spring, and it helps put nutrition back in your soil. So a common one is winter ryegrass or vetch or even clover.
We're seeing more and more heirloom vegetables in the green markets. Are they difficult to grow?
No, very easy. In fact, it's preferable to grow heirlooms because you can collect the seeds. So we'll be having some seed-saving workshops in October to educate community gardeners at harvest fairs like the one on September 7th at the Winnaqua Garden in the Bronx, if anybody wants to join us on East 136th Street with the Parks Department. There'll be seed-saving workshops, and heirlooms are the types of plants that are open-pollinated, which means that they're not hybrids. If you take a hybrid plant and you try to plant the seed, you will get a plant that resembles the parent, one of the parents. But with heirlooms, what you plant from seed is what you get from the previous plant. So they're true to seed. So people like collecting the seeds of heirlooms because what you plant is what you're going to get. And that's called open pollinated. So heirlooms are easy to grow. There's a wide variety. You see them everywhere. And they're delicious vegetables and fruits.
Let's take another call. Emily, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I have a question. I have from Sandy. I lost all my juniper trees and my Russian olives on Fire Island. They all look very dead. some people say to me, wait till next year before you cut them down. They may come back. Do you think there's any chance they'll come back?
If it's 50% brown, you've lost it. And I was on the Jersey Shore recently, and one of the recommended seaside evergreens is the Leland Cypress. So you might want to choose that. Junipers are pretty hardy, but I saw a lot of damage of the junipers. But if you go to any of the seashore planting websites or Google plants that are tolerant of drought along the seashore, you'll find the Leyland cypress, L-E-Y-L-A-N-D, cypress.
I have to tell you, in Fire Island, all the gardeners were recommending those.
Right.
Everyone on Fire Island is now rust brown.
Sure.
I would not recommend those.
Well, on Fire Island,
very badly with Sandy.
Of course, things that were destroyed completely. I'm saying relative, those plants are best. You're not going to find anything that's going to survive something like the devastation on Fire Island, because the salt concentration was just too consistent and high over a very long period of time. But what I'm telling you is that based on most of the evergreens, the Leyland cypress survives the most. And then you'll find other plants that do well on the seashore, like I mentioned earlier, the crepe myrtle, amelanchier or shad blow, Rosa rugosa, what else? Bayberry, serviceberry. So look for seashore plantings. And if people go to our website, we'd be happy to send you a list of plants that do well on the seashore. You could go to our website as well, grownyc.org.
Fred from Queens, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm in Two Community Garden, Southeast Queens. We usually successfully grow okra. This year, we're not even getting flowers. It's not that it's not pollinated. It's just that the flowers are not coming.
Hmm. Are you getting any? Well, if you're not getting flowers, then you're not getting any okra, right?
Right? Where I could tell you, we harvested a huge amount of okra from the Via Verde roof garden. So lots of pollinators up on the roof garden, full sun. In general, when you don't get flower production, it could be a nutrition problem. Plants need basic nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. And for flower and seed production, they have to have a well-balanced nutrition. So it could be that you need to give it some compost or some fertilizer.
Now, when do you prefer fertilizer and when do you prefer compost?
It's interchangeable, yeah. We like to do non-petroleum-based fertilizer, so compost is generally organic, so you want to go with that or any kind of organic fertilizer. But I don't know your situation in particular, but I would say that, you know, plant pollinators around the vegetable garden like marigolds to attract them. But if you're not even getting the fruit, it could be a nutrition problem where you don't get fruit production.
I have two gardens about a mile distant from one another. The one is built kind of...
Okay, and the other thing I'm wondering is it still a little early? Did you plant your okra late? Because the okra is not going to flower until it's mature. So how high is your okra?
Well, mine is a shoulder high. For some reason, my plants get among the highest. I don't know why, whatever's in my soil.
But do you have fruit on your okra?
No.
No, either.
No.
Okay, then that's
yeah. But most don't.
If you put too much nitrogen in the garden, you get a lot of green leafy growth and less fruit and flower production. So if I was looking at that, I would check your nutrition. And if you want, you could send me a leaf sample or a soil sample, and we could send it off to Cornell University for a soil and leaf analysis.
And where do they send it to, Gerard?
You could send it to 51 Chambers Street, room 228, New York, New York, 10007, care of Grow NYC Garden Program.
And we will post that on our website later in the day. We have a listener, Anne from West Harlem, who writes, "This summer I was collecting tasty mulberries from the trees along Riverside Drive in uptown Manhattan. None of my friends wanted to eat them because they said they were sprayed with chemicals and were full of city soot. Do you agree?"
I eat the mulberries from the trees in New York City, and I'm still here to talk about it. So, I mean, you have to be concerned. public parks are not sprayed with chemical toxic chemicals because of the very fact that they are public parks, and the Parks Department is very sensitive and careful about that. As far as the soot goes, yeah, you rinse them off a little bit, but there are delicious red and purple mulberries, white mulberries that I eat around the city all the time. People even make jams and pies from them.
That caller who was asking about the okra brings to mind the fact that I think every person who gardens wonders why not this year. Like, I have a great tomato crop, I have wonderful squash and cucumbers, but for some reason the herbs are not doing well.
Right.
Last year the herbs were doing great and the tomatoes weren't doing well.
Right. It's, you know, we're dependent on the weather, which is somewhat finicky. A lot of gardeners keep journals and they keep records of things that they did so it can remind them, oh, we have to do it this way because it was successful for the tomatoes that we grew this way. And planting things in different locations help. If you have a tomato disease, you don't want to plant tomatoes in the same spot the next year because that soil-borne disease could cause a problem. This year we had no impatience because of a disease. So we have to be careful, and every year it's a little different.
Last year was that tomato blight, and
right.
We're not seeing much of that this year.
Exactly. So it changes year to year. So just a reminder for your listeners that this is the last time during the season that you want to, you know, as I said, transplant your evergreens now, order your fruit trees. Don't prune any of your spring flowering shrubs like lilac, forsythia, or mock orange right now.
And Gerard, you mentioned that there are classes or there are programs to teach people how to take care of some pretty complicated gardening matters. How do they get in touch with you to find out about them?
You could go to our website at grownyc.org. And we have over 60 green markets around the city. We have recycling workshops around the city teaching people about the city efforts recently to recycle everything. We collect 11,000 tons of waste generated by New York. Well, actually, a huge amount of textiles, 2 million pounds were collected. So we have lots of workshops on recycling, on teaching kids how to be environmentalists. And at the green markets, there are cooking demonstrations as well.
And we have a link to your website on our show page at WNYC.org. Gerard, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Gerard Lordahl is Director of Open Space Greening at Grow NYC, which teaches, recycles, and handles the green markets. It's always a great pleasure. Well, let me repeat that. It's always a great pleasure to have you here, Gerard.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Leonard.